I met John Mackay once, and I was corrected that it's Mackay, and this is important because there's a paper of Miles Reed and Tom Bridgeland and Alistair King called Mackay Implies Mackay, and it's not funny if we say Mackay. Okay, so the plan is to review this Mackay correspondence or some aspects of it for C2, and then I want to discuss a Mackay correspondence for the complex projective line P1 that was developed by Alexander Kirillov Jr. And then finally, what I want to really get to is to develop an analog of these two things for the cotangent bundle of P1. This is a complex cotangent bundle. So everything is going to be holomorphic or complex algebraic. And roughly what this is going to do is to provide some kind of bridge between these two Mackay correspondences. So we'll have some data on P1, and by pulling back under the projection, it's going to give us some constructions on the cotangent model of P1, and everything that happens here is going to be equivalent to what happens here. So this is going to be in some derived sense. So let me begin with Mackay for P2. First, there's this observation of John Mackay that there's a one-to-one correspondence between finite subgroups of SL2C taken up to conjugacy. And affine Dinkin diagrams of type ADE. So these are like the normal Dinkin diagrams with an extra vertex. And the way this works is, given such a finite subgroup, I want to construct a graph gamma, and the vertices are labeled by the reducible representations of my group G. And the edges, so the number of edges from the ith vertex to the jth vertex is given as the dimension of some intertwiners. So I take the reducible representation corresponding to the ith vertex, the reducible representation corresponding to the jth vertex, and I tensor with this standard two-dimensional representation that I have because G is an SL2. Okay, so I'm counting the number of times VI appears in a decomposition of V tensor VJ. And at this point, you can simply compute these things and notice that what you get are affine Dinkin diagrams. So this is not, doesn't explain much, but you can see this in a simple example. Can one see this half of the board? Okay. So the simple example, it works the same for all cyclic groups, but I'll just do Z bond 4 so we can draw the whole thing. So we'll take our group in SL2 to be generated by I minus I. So just write, so this is an SL2. This is a cyclic of order 4. It has 4 irreducible representations, which I'll draw like this. I'm going to label them as V0, the trivial representation, V1, so that's essentially this representation, where it's acting as a primitive 4-3 to unity, and the other ones are just tensor powers of this. Okay. And so the standard representation V, written in this way, decomposes as V1 plus V3. And now if I want to, say, figure out the edges from here to here, I need to compute the dimension of, say, homomorphisms from V0 to V tensor V1. If I tensor V1 here, I'll get a V2 and a V4, which is the same as V0, so I'll have one V0 in the decomposition of this. So the dimension here will be 1. There's going to be one edge here. And because the representation V is self-dual, it turns out this is symmetric. So it doesn't matter which order you compute it in. And you can play a similar game and go around here, and you get the Dinkin diagram A3 together with this extra vertex. Okay, and then one can compute this for the other kinds of groups. There are sort of double covers of dihedral groups and double covers of polyhedral groups, and you get the diagrams. And this is just some very curious observation. So there are a number of explanations for this. So more geometrically, one can consider, as mentioned in Joel Kammnitzer's talk, the group G acting on C2, and I can take the quotient. This is some singular complex surface called a Kleinian singularity. It was studied by Felix Klein. It has a minimal resolution. And basically what happens with minimal resolution, you can get this by blowing up the singular points until you're done. And at each step, you introduce a P1. And these P1s, the exceptional divisor of this resolution, have some configuration. And if you put a dot on each component and connect them where they intersect, you get the finite type Dinkin diagram. And somehow the extra vertex is corresponding to the entire collection. Okay, so one can somehow make this more, make a stronger statement. So we can consider equivariant sheaves. So coherent equivariant sheaves on C2. And we can try to relate these to coherent sheaves on this resolution. And at the level of their Grothendieck group circuit theory, this was first done by Gonzalez, Sprinberg, and Verdier. And building on what they did, Kapranov and Vassero were able to construct a derived equivalence between these two categories. So here this is a derived equivalence, and derived categories in algebraic geometry are sort of capturing sort of stable phenomena like you would have in topology. So it's an algebraic geometer's version of the stable homotopy category. What these are basically is just complexes of sheaves, and we like to consider two the same when there's a map between them that induces an isomorphism on cohomology. So in topology, you would like to consider two spaces roughly the same when there's a weak equivalence between them, a continuous map inducing isomorphisms on all homotopy groups. And there's another more algebraic version of this that will be relevant to what I want to talk about. So among objects here, there's some special equivariant vector bundles. They're sort of the obvious thing. I can consider C2 as just an equivariant vector bundle over a point with a projection pi. And I can take the irreducibles, representations of G, which I think is vector bundle sitting over here on the point, and I can pull them back to the total space of this vector bundle. Okay, and because this projection is equivariant, these will naturally have an action of my group. And I can sum these all up, and what this gives me is a functor from equivariant sheaves on C2 to modules over some algebra, which is just endomorphisms of this vector bundle that are invariant under the group action. I'm going to call this B. And what this functor does is it takes, say, an equivariant vector bundle or sheaf and looks at all homomorphisms that are equivariant from the sum of vector bundles into the sheaf F. Okay. And the reason I put this opposite algebra in here is that this thing will act on this thing by precomposition, so it'll be a right action, and I'm just turning it into a left action of the algebra B. And one can show that actually this is just an equivalence before taking derived categories. Okay, so this is some non-commutative algebra that describes equivariant vector bundles and more generally sheaves on C2. And you could ask, how is that related to all this Dinkin stuff? And one can show it's not too hard that this algebra B does have a description in terms of the Dinkin diagram. It's isomorphic to what's called the p-projective algebra of gamma. And what this is, I can try to illustrate with an example, is I make a quiver on my diagram, so a directed graph. I introduce arrows going in both directions. Okay. So I'm going to call that Q bar. And I can take the path algebra of this. So what this is the algebra over C that has the basis paths in this directed graph. And the multiplication is just concatenation of paths. So I can follow this two-step path by, say, that two-step path and get a four-step path, or if they don't line up, I just get zero. So this is the path algebra of Q. And it turns out this algebra B isn't quite this, but it's some quotient of this. There are certain relations involved. So you have to take certain arrows for some orientation of the diagram and take their commutators of, say, alpha and its reverse arrow. So these are the so-called pre-projective relations. In geometry, it turns out they come up when studying moduli spaces of representations of this algebra, which also give a way of constructing this resolution concretely. So this is somehow the background on what one can say about C2. There are a lot of papers, I've seen a lot of talks on this. What's less known, perhaps, is there's a nice Mackay correspondence for P1 due to Kirillov Jr. I recently talked to him and asked him, and his son's name is Ivan. I was kind of disappointed. So instead of finite subgroups of SL2 now, what we're going to take is finite subgroups of PSL2. So this is the thing that acts faithfully on P1. Okay. And the basic idea is to relate G tilde equivariant geometry of the projective line to some Dinkin data. Okay. So let's just begin. By seeing what kind of nice vector bundles or sheaves we can cook up on P1 that are equivariant. So we always have the line bundles, which are just classified by the first Chern class. And in particular, this one is special. It's the sort of hyperplane bundle. It sits inside the trivial bundle with fiber V, and over a point, it just picks out the line in V to which that point on P1 corresponds. And so since this has a natural G action, and this is stable under that G action, all of these guys become well, sort of naturally G equivariant for the double cover here. Now there's a bit of an issue. If I take the finite subgroup in SL2 that double covers this, it has a kernel plus or minus by identity. Okay. And this plus or minus identity will only act trivially on even degree line bundles. So those will descend to be equivariant under this quotient of G by plus or minus identity. Okay. So I want to think of these as even sheaves. And these are the same as G tilde sheaves. Okay. The other obvious things we have are sort of trivial vector bundles with fiber one of the irreducible representations. So these are the irreps. And again, plus or minus identity acts trivially on some of these and non-trivially on others. Okay, so we also have even and odd representations. So in this example, of course, plus or minus identity acts trivially on the trivial representation. It acts non-trivially on these two guys. If you take the square of this, you get minus identity, and it'll act non-trivially here. And then again, it'll act trivially here. So these ones are the even representations. And these guys are the odd representations. So we have these two things that we can work with. We have these line bundles, and we have these vector bundles whose fiber is just an irreducible representation. And from these, we can form some equivariant vector bundles. And I want them to be G tilde equivariant, so I want plus or minus identity to act trivially on them. And the way we ensure this is that the representation that I choose and the line bundle that I choose should have the same parity. So they should be both even or both odd. If they're both even, then of course plus or minus identity acts trivially. If they're both odd, minus identity will cancel with itself on either side. Okay. So let's look at some examples. So again, I'm going to take G to be a cyclic group of order 4. G tilde is a quotient of it. It just turns out to be isomorphic to Z mod 2. Okay. And we're looking at this diagram. And what I want to do is right here just put C0, that's an even sheaf. Okay. here, I'm supposed to have V1, but that's not quite an even sheaf, because minus identity will act non-trivially. But if I tensor it with O1, the two non-trivial actions of minus identity cancel out. Then V2 is okay, but V3 is not, so I need to throw in an O1. Okay? So this is some collection of equivariant G tilde equivariant vector bundles labeled by the vertices of the graph. And I'm going to make this graph into a quiver, give it a direction, where I'm just going to let the edges flow downhill from a line bundle of higher degree to one of lower degree. Okay. And all of this is organized in general, for general graphs, by what's called a height function. Which is an integer valued function on the vertices of my graph gamma corresponding to my group, such that the height of a given vertex, so the line bundle I'm going to stick there, I want it to have the same parity as the representation at that vertex. So these should be congruent mod 2. And the second thing is that as I go from one vertex to the next, I want to do this in a stepwise fashion. So I want to go from, you know, degree 1 to 0 or degree 5 to 6. So the difference between neighboring vertices is just 1, so if I and J are connected in the diagram. So let me quickly do two more examples. I had this one on that other board, which was 0, 1, 0, 1. That was a height function. Here, let me put a minus 1, so that preserves the parity and the stepwise nature of a height function. And then over here, I want to put a 2 here. Okay? So again, preserving the parity and the stepwise nature of the height function. Okay? And what am I doing? I'm essentially picking a vertex that is a source, meaning all arrows are coming out. I'm changing it to a sink where all arrows are coming in. Okay? So I'm going to call this operation where I've subtracted 2 from the first vertex, sigma 1 minus. Similarly here, I turned a sink into a source by adding 2, and that happened at the second vertex. Okay. Let me try to write it here. And it's a fact that you can get from one height function to another height function by sequence of such things. So they're connected by such operations. Okay, so this is going to be our means of relating these different things. And now I can state Kirilov's theorem, which is going to relate these equivariant vector bundles to some Dinkin stuff. Theorem of Kirilov. First, if I sum all these up for a fixed height function, so maybe I should give them a name. Once I fix the height function, I get a collection of equivariant vector bundles. I'm going to call them FIHs. I take the ith irreducible and I tensor with the line bundle of height at that vertex. So the first statement is that if I take the invariant endomorphisms of the sum of this collection of vector bundles, that turns out to be some well-known thing, It's the path algebra of the quiver, which I described here. I gave an orientation on my graph by letting the arrows flow downhill. So this quiver is induced by H. And specifically what happens is basically this edge is given by morphisms from this object into that object. And the second thing is that there's a natural functor from the bounded dry category. So I'm just taking bounded complexes of G tilde equivariant sheaves to modules over this algebra that I'm going to call AH. So this is finite length complexes of modules over this algebra. I'll give it a name, phi H. And like in the case for the plane, this is going to be homomorphisms from the sum of these things into my object. Except I want to do this in a derived way, so you have to somehow replace these by some reasonable resolutions and take the complex of morphisms. This is the derived functor of homomorphisms. So Kirilov's first statement is that this is an equivalence. Okay, so you should think of this as analogous to this equivalence with the pre-projective algebra and equivariant sheaves on C2, except now this wouldn't be true if I didn't take derived categories. Okay, this wouldn't be true at the level of just abelian categories. And finally, the last part. So why does this happen? So the first thing, so there's no way that the equivariant coherent sheaves on P1 is going to be equivalent to modules over some finite dimensional algebra, because modules over finite dimensional algebra, that we have enough projective resolutions of every module, we have enough injective resolutions, and there are in general no projective objects in a category of coherent sheaves, not even the structure sheaf. And injectives are usually way too big, so they don't lie in the category of coherent sheaves. So you just shouldn't expect that to happen. Where here, because C2 is affine, that the projective-injective thing is not such a problem. Okay, so finally the third part of this is, I have one of these equivalences for every height function, and I could relate the quivers for the different height functions by some reflection gadgets. So how are these different equivalences related? And the answer is by some pretty triangle. So it's this diagram that first got me interested in this whole business. So I have this equivalence to the path algebra of the quiver for H. And maybe path algebra for a different quiver where I modified at some vertex by adding to or subtracting to. So what fits in here? The answer is the so-called BGP reflection functors. So these are due to Bernstein, Gelfand, and Ponomaryov. They introduced these in order to prove Gabriel's theorem about which quivers have finite representation type. And these are actually derived equivalences, and they make this diagram commute. Okay. So why this first interested me is that the Grothendieck groups of these two categories are easily identified with each other. For representations of a quiver like this, I could just put a one-dimensional vector space sitting at this vertex and zeros elsewhere, and that'll be a simple representation. And it turns out those simpler representations form a basis for the Grothendieck group. And since these guys have the same underlying graphs, they have the same vertices, they have the same simples. So there's this fixed Grothendieck group for these categories, and it has a basis given by those labels. So this is just the affine root lattice. Type gamma. And the reflection functors here induce the action of the Weyl group. Of the affine Weyl group. So this reflection at a single vertex is the simple reflection. So this is nice, but it's also a little bit disappointing because these reflection functors are somehow not acting as symmetries of this category. I had to make this identification between Grothendieck groups of two different categories. And of course, the super thing going all the way around doesn't work because that's just identity. Okay, so I don't have an affine Weyl group action here or a Bray group action there. So I would like to realize these symmetries in some more global way. Right. Okay. So this is going to bring me to the Mackay correspondence for the cotangent bundle of P1, which is going to allow us to pick up this Weyl group symmetry in a more global way as symmetries of our category, and is going to relate the Mackay correspondence for P1 to that for C2. So the first question is, why would you start with the cotangent bundle of P1? So the sort of naive answer is that if you draw this thing, it roughly looks like this, in the sense that the zero section of the cotangent bundle sits in there, inside there is a conic, because this is a degree minus 2 line bundle. And if you contract the zero section, you get the quadric cone. And the quadric cone, if you work this out, is just the quotient of C2 by plus or minus the identity. So somehow, the cotangent bundle knew that we're ignoring this action of plus or minus the identity, and it's somehow going to provide the bridge to C2. So what I'm going to do is, in the C2 case, we had these natural equivariant vector bundles, just the vector bundles whose fiber was the irreducible representation. And in the P1 case, we had these vector bundles that we cooked up with a height function that gave us equivalence with the quiver. So we're going to do a similar thing here. And it's rather simple. So I take the projection to P1. At some point, I'm also going to be interested in the zero section. And I just pull back these vector bundles, FIHs, okay, and sum them up, and take their endomorphism algebra, I call that BH. It depends upon the height function. And the first result is, well, what is this algebra? So it turns out that the algebra BH is isomorphic to the pre-projective algebra of the diagram. I'm telling this story a little out of order. This isn't actually the first thing you see, but maybe it's the first thing I want to tell you. And then, just like in the P1 case, I can consider the functor from equivariant sheaves on the cotangent bundle to derived category of modules over the pre-projective algebra. I'll call that psi h. Okay. And it's the same thing. I take an object and send it in from homomorphisms from my vector bundle into that object. And that's an equivalence. Okay. So I have one of these for each h. So are the talks 50 minutes? 45 minutes? 10 minutes? Okay. So good. I wanted to state this. Now I want to step back a few steps. So in order to tell you how these different equivalences are related. So we have one for each height function, just like we had for P1. And like I said, I want to realize some global symmetries that are going to relate these. So back to P1 for a second. I have this equivalence here with representations of the quiver corresponding to the height function. And I could take the simple representations here that correspond to a vertex, just a one-dimensional vector space sitting at the vertex, and I can look at where they go under this inverse equivalence. Okay? And whatever those things are, I'm going to call them EIHs. All right? And like I said, these formed a basis for the Grundy group over here. They correspond to the simple roots. So they're also going to play the role of simple roots over here. And now what I want to do is take these gadgets and push them forward along the zero section here. So I'm going to define some new objects, script EIs. Just push forward these simple roots along the zero section. These will be objects in the derived category of the cotangent bundle. And the theorem is that these guys here are spherical objects, just like we're introduced in Joel's talk. So that means that if I take the X algebra from this fellow to itself, it looks like cohomology of the two-sphere. And then also, there were autoequivalences of the category associated to spherical objects. These are called spherical twists. So these spherical twists generate an action of the Bragg group of type gamma. On my category. And finally, these spherical twists, the twists, relate to various equivalences. This can be made precise in a number of ways, also the way in which they're an analog of the reflection functors. Let me give one nice way. If I have a height function h and another height function which I change to sink into a source, I have this collection of spherical objects which are like a collection of simple roots. And over here I have the new collection corresponding to the new height function. So you could ask how these are related. Let me put a minus here. Okay. And the relation is quite precise. If I take a spherical object corresponding to a jth vertex, and I apply the twisted I, this will give me the spherical object for the new height function, where I turn the source into a sink. And over here, if I were at a sink instead of a source, I have to throw in the inverse functor here. And in some way that can be made precise, this really kind of lifts the action of the reflection functors down here. Okay. So we'd like to just end with a question. Well, let me summarize. Here. So, for P1, the equivariant geometry of P1 is related to representations of a quiver associated to gamma for each height function. Okay. Over here, the equivariant geometry of C2 is related to representations of the pre-projective algebra associated to that diagram. And the cotangent bundle of P1 sort of interpolates between the two. So here I can pull back collections of vector bundles coming from height functions, or I can push forward simple objects and get spherical objects. And then here I have these various equivalences to the pre-projective algebra, and therefore to equivariant sheaves on C2, and therefore to sheaves on the resolution of the singularity. Okay. So one of the reasons I originally came at this problem was that these two categories have been studied a lot. And of course, you could guess that under this equivalence, there's a Braid group action over here. And in the original paper of Seidel-Thomas, where they introduced spherical objects, they showed that in type A, this Braid group action is faithful. So in type A, Braid group action is faithful. And this is an open question in cases D and E. And I hope to be able to address this in the future using this relation between the cotangent bundle of P1 and P1 itself, where everything is very explicit and easy to compute down here. So anyone who knows how to find Braid group actions on combinatorial objects and show that they're faithful should come and talk to me. So I'll stop there. Right. I don't know. So this would, you would want a class in H3 maybe on the resolution here. So H2 is the finite type root lattice. I'm not sure what H3 is, so I don't know. That's right. So I thought some about this. Yeah, and in fact, I mean, anytime you have this sort of equivalent from some base variety to anamorphisms of some object, this will pull back to a similar equivalence on the total space of any vector bundle. Yes. On which?
Mokai correspondence for any Riemann surface?
No.
It was for the Mokai volume for last year. It was the same kind of concept.
I see.
It's
right.
Uh-huh. So that's okay. I do very similar thing. This is just in fact for...